Good morning, and thank you for joining me on the Path to Liberty. I'm Michael Bolden with the 10th Amendment Center, and this is the show for Monday, September 18th, 2023. And today in history, September 18th, 1850, the Second Federal Fugitive Slave Act was signed into law. I think it was one of the most morally repugnant acts ever passed. I'm going to go over what it was, and you can make your own decision on that. But I think it's important to also discuss the constitutional provisions or the constitutional discussions behind this, and also, more importantly for our efforts today, how the states responded to it and actually, in many ways, won. Now, first of all, it's important to point out that the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was part of what was called the Compromise of 1850. That was a package of five separate bills passed by Congress in September of that year that temporarily diffused tensions between slave and free states in the years leading up to what we mostly call the Civil War. I know other people have other names for it, but we'll go with that. Designed by Whig Senator Henry Clay, this is kind of the mainstream overview here, and Democratic Senator Stephen A. Douglas, with the support of President Millard Fillmore, the compromise centered on how to handle slavery in recently acquired territories from the Mexican-American War. But there was also the Fugitive Slave Act, which was an attempt to really kind of beef up what they had passed in 1793. And Mike Meharry put it this way. The Fugitive Slave Act set up a legal structure to facilitate the capture of runaway slaves and their return to their owners. I like how he put that in scare quotes. Abolitionists dubbed it a bloodhound law. It significantly expanded the provisions of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793, and unsurprisingly, it was very unpopular, extremely unpopular in northern states. Here from Wikipedia, which actually has a, not always great, but has a pretty good overview here. The earlier Fugitive Slave Act of 1793 was a federal law that was written with the intent to enforce Article 4, Section 2, Clause 3 of the Constitution for the United States. This is the Fugitive Slave Clause, which required the return of escaped slaves. It sought to force the authorities in free states to return fugitives of enslavement to their enslavers. In essence, it was commandeering many of the people of the free states. We could say that. Now, would you be surprised to learn that almost every place you read about the Fugitive Slave Clause has a kind of a lie by omission? They don't tell the whole story, and then they present the picture of what they want to say, but without all the information. This is how it always seems to go on all this stuff, but also on the Fugitive Slave Clause as well, which they don't really need. I can't understand why it's done like this. Here from congress.gov, this is how they put it. Following the debate on the constitutional provision, this is in the Philadelphia Convention in 1787, following the debate on the constitutional provision requiring states to return felons who had fled from one state to another, Pierce Butler, along with Charles Pinckney of South Carolina, moved to add to that. They wanted to add, quote, require fugitive slaves and servants to be delivered up like criminals. That was on August 28, 1787. Next, they say, although James Wilson and Roger Sherman objected, well, James Wilson objected this way. Roger Sherman added a little sarcasm to it. James Wilson said, this would oblige, so that's a falsehood as well. Wilson said, this would oblige the executive of the state to seize these fugitives at the public expense. So they're pointing out that the provision brought forward by Pierce Butler and Charles Pinckney to require fugitive slaves and servants to be delivered up by criminals would, according to the big legal mind of James Wilson, which not a lot of people disagreed with on his legal thoughts in the Philadelphia Convention, even though he didn't get everything that he wanted done there, he may not have been super influential until really his Statehouse Yard speech of 1787, but that's a side note. Wilson said, you know, your proposal is going to require a positive action at the expense of the state of the executive of each state. And so Congress.gov says, well, then the provision was approved by the convention unanimously without further debate. So it's almost as if, well, it's not almost as if, Congress.gov is literally telling us patently false information because of an omission. This is not what happened. As a result, if you read this, you get the idea that, well, the states are required to take action. No one disagreed with James Wilson there that this provision would have done this, and the states are required to pay for it. but they're ignoring the fact that in response to this, something else happened. Now, Constitution Center tells almost the same story. They say the clause was adopted at the Constitutional Convention of 1787 on the motion of Pierce Butler and Charles Pinckney. In opposition, James Wilson disagreed because, quote, this would oblige the executive of the state to return fugitive slaves at the public expense. And then they said the proposal was withdrawn, but then adopted a day later with no dispute. But that's not what they adopted. What happened was something different. We get almost the same story at Cornell Law School and pretty much everywhere else. So here's what really happened. First, on August 6th, the Committee of Detail report was presented. This was basically a proposed draft of the Constitution in August. It was delivered by John Rutledge. And here, Article 15 is what they had at that point. Any person charged with treason, felony, or high misdemeanor in any state who shall flee from justice and shall be found in any other state shall, on demand of the executive power of the state from which he fled, be delivered up and removed to the state having jurisdiction of the offense. That was August 6th. Then, on August 28th, Pierce Butler and Charles Pinckney made their proposal, which was they moved to require, quote, fugitive slaves and servants to be delivered up by criminals. James Wilson responded, saying this would oblige the executive of the state to do it at public expense. Sherman also was not on board with that. This is not proper. And so Mr. Butler, and here's what they're skipping in all these overviews, whether it's at Cornell Law School or Constitution Center or at congress.gov, they're all missing the point that he withdrew his proposition in order that some particular provision might be made apart from this article. So they were going to come up with a different approach. And when they came back, they actually came back with a different version that did not include the language that James Wilson said would require the states to take positive action and pay for it. So they did not include a requirement that fugitive slaves and servants be delivered up like criminals, period. That's not in the text. They approved unanimously a version that did not oblige the executive of the state to do it at public expense. And here's the final version after some revisions. No person held to service or labor in one state, under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due. So they're basically saying, okay, you cannot, just because you get to a free state doesn't mean you all of a sudden get freedom. Now, I think that's morally repugnant. That's a whole different discussion, but this is what the Constitution says. This is what they approved. Now, because the Fugitive Slave Clause had no express requirement for states to help catch people, Congress passed and George Washington signed the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793. And here, this is despite the fact that I think that it was repeatedly held during ratification that the feds did not have the power to require states to help them enforce stuff unless you were Hamiltonian. It shall be the duty of the executive here's what it says in the act. It shall be the duty of the executive authority of the state or territory to which such person shall have fled to cause him or her arrest to be given to the executive authority making such demand, or to the agent when he shall appear. But if no agent shall appear within 6 months, the prisoner may be discharged, and all costs or expenses incurred in the apprehending, securing, and transmitting such fugitive to the state or territory making such demand shall be paid by such state or territory. So there's a little bit of a commandeering here, and I want to just point out as a quick aside, people like Oliver Ellsworth, who was the third Chief Justice, said this Constitution does not attempt to coerce sovereign bodies, states, in their political capacity. Or James Madison, writing in Federalist 46, January of 1788, he pointed out that states should use, and individuals should use, a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union for in response to both unwarrantable acts, that's James Madison's term in that context, as an unconstitutional act. So if a state saw a federal act as unconstitutional, they should say, well, we're not going to participate. But also, James Madison said, this should be in response to warrantable federal acts that are bad policy that the state doesn't agree with. Now, this has been upheld surprisingly, by the Supreme Court for a long time in something called the anti-commandeering doctrine. It really got its genesis, at least in Supreme Court opinions. Now, of course, all these opinions could technically be wrong. They do support the position that I'm saying. So, of course, maybe I just have confirmation bias here. But this is the first one, the Prigg versus Pennsylvania case of 1842. And here, Justice Joseph Story, who was not an originalist, maybe we could call him an originalist, but a bad one. He was not on our side when it comes to the founders' original constitution, but here he held that the federal government could not force states to implement or carry out the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793. He said it was a federal law, and the federal government ultimately had to enforce it. That's in response. The reason that case came up is because a number of northern states, 1820 or so through 1842, had passed legislation that attempted to interfere with enforcement of that federal Fugitive Slave Act of 1793. And so he's basically saying, look, this is under the Fugitive Slave Clause, and you guys are required to to do something, but you're not required to do the enforcement part of it. That's up to the feds. You can't be required to be slave catchers, for example. And here's how he put it. The fundamental principle applicable to all cases of this sort would seem to be that where the end is required, the means are given. And where the duty is enjoined, the ability to perform it is contemplated to exist on the part of the functionaries to whom it is entrusted. So it was entrusted, this power was delegated to the federal government in the Constitution for the United States. And Story correctly points out that this is a clause in the Constitution for the United States, not in the state constitution. So the states can't be compelled to implement it. He said the clause is found in the national constitution. I hate that phrase, national constitution, but whatever. And not in that of any state. It does not point out any state functionaries or any state action to carry its provisions into effect. So it's literally just, and I'm not certain if he's really getting this from what I was referencing from the Philadelphia Convention, the fact that the original version from Butler and Pinckney would have, as James Wilson mentioned, required the states to act by using criminal, hand them up like criminals. This, under under all understanding of it, would have required a positive action at their expense. But that was taken out. And so when the people of the several states debated the Constitution, debated ratification, they weren't debating the idea that the states had to act on this. And I think Story was correct here. The states cannot, therefore, he said, be compelled to enforce them. And it might well be deemed an unconstitutional exercise of the power of interpretation to insist that the states are bound to provide means to carry into effect the duties of the national government, nowhere delegated or entrusted to them by the Constitution. I should just point out one more time, the fact that he calls it a national government makes my skin crawl, but the underlying principle, I think, makes sense according to the structure of the original legal meaning of the Constitution. That is, it's a federal act, and if the feds want to enforce it, the feds want to do it, they can't require the states to participate, because it doesn't specifically say. Now, if the Constitution had said what James Wilson was talking about there, or what Butler had proposed, then the states would have been required to act. And here from Wikipedia, the page on Prigg versus Pennsylvania, they say Story's phrase, unless prohibited by state legislation, this is another part of the opinion, was a catalyst for a number of personal liberty laws enacted by Pennsylvania and other northern states in response. So there were personal liberty laws that were passed prior to 1842, and then the Pennsylvania law was held to be unconstitutional in the fact that it was interfering. They were interfering with federal enforcement, but then at the same time, so it's kind of like a halfway. You can't interfere with federal enforcement, according to the Supreme Court, but you don't have to help. That was reiterated. So then after 1842 and up until 1855, there were a bunch more personal liberty laws passed or updated to basically fit within this court opinion. I mean, whether you agree with it or not, strategically, that's always a good approach, because then you have one less battle to fight. You don't have to fight the legal experts or the so-called legal experts saying that you're not allowed to do this. So Story's phrase, unless prohibited by state legislation, was a catalyst for a number of personal liberty laws enacted by Pennsylvania and other northern states. The laws prohibited state officials from interfering with runaway or fugitive slaves in any capacity. I'm not sure if that's a perfect description there, but not bad. Runaways could not be caught or incarcerated by state action. Cases could not be heard in state courts. And no assistance could be offered by state officials to those wishing to recapture slaves. The Fugitive Slave Act still stood of 1793, but only federal agents could enforce it. This is known as the Anti-Commandeering Doctrine. This is an update over the last few years that someone actually included Anti-Commandeering Doctrine there. So the states stopped helping, and then after 1842, the feds were having a pretty difficult time getting it enforced, so they tried to strengthen it in response. They passed the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, but I think the way that they tried to implement the Fugitive Slave Clause, and now, of course, I think the Fugitive Slave Clause is awful, but it's there. We're not talking about that part of it. The way they tried to implement it, they enact this, they went, well, I guess we could just say they went overboard. They went over the top. And here back to Mike Meharry. The law, this is again the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 that we're getting into. The law erased any semblance of due process for an accused runaway slave. A white man could basically drag a black man or woman into slavery on the power of his word. Accused runaways weren't even allowed to testify in their own defense. So they set up this, not really a trial system, but kind of, where they would hear these cases about, someone would say, okay, this is my property. And then they would get caught, and then they would be brought to this case where a commissioner, not technically a judge, with proper judicial power, the commissioner would hear the case. And the person presenting evidence of ownership, their evidence was admitted in court. But the person who is claimed to be a runaway slave, who is claimed to be a fugitive from slavery, from ownership, they couldn't provide any information in their own defense. And I'm not sure where in the Constitution the federal government is empowered or delegated a power to do such a thing. But to me, there couldn't be a more clear violation of the Fifth Amendment eliminating due process than this. And here's how it's put directly. This is in Section 6 of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. In no trial or hearing under this act shall the testimony of such alleged fugitive be admitted in evidence. Just straight up. You can't even say, well, I was born here and I got a birth certificate. Even if you faked it, you couldn't even provide it. There was nothing you could do. You absolutely had to keep your mouth shut and just take whatever they said against you. You were not treated as a human being. And I don't think that really fits within the Constitution. Maybe you do, but if that's the case, we're probably not good friends. In no trial or hearing under this act shall the testimony of such alleged fugitive be admitted in evidence. And the certificates in this and the first fourth section mentioned shall be conclusive of the right of the person or persons in whose favor granted to remove such fugitive to the state or territory from which he escaped, and shall prevent all molestation of such person or persons by any process issued by any court, judge, magistrate, or other person whomsoever. In other words, someone possibly escapes to the north, and then someone says, you're my property. They get caught. They present this information. It goes into this hearing or trial, and the person can't even say, no, you're wrong. You've got me confused with someone else. And we do know there were certainly a number of people that were wrongly, I think everybody was wrongly sent to slavery. Of course, that should be obvious. But under this particular law, people that couldn't defend themselves, they were just sent back, and maybe they were born in freedom. I mean, even though everyone's born in freedom, I got to stop correcting myself on that and putting modern moral judgments on this. I don't want to get into that. Anyways, the most glaring constitutional problem, Mike writes, with the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was its denial of due process. A fugitive was to be returned south on the word of any white person. The accused was not even allowed to present evidence in his own defense. Under the Fugitive Slave Act, accused runaway slaves had no recourse. They started under the presumption of guilt, and the process made it impossible to prove otherwise. This clearly violates the Fifth Amendment. I don't think there is anything that could be more obvious. No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Due process of law includes a fair trial, a fair hearing, and one side being able to present evidence and the other side is not considered by any standard within the standards of due process of law. Now, on top of it, the people, the commissioners who are doing, I'll get to that in a moment. Mike says, unless you want to argue black people weren't persons, and this is pretty much what the federal courts ultimately did, an accused fugitive had a right to an actual trial. As it stood, the Fugitive Slave Act stripped all rights from a black person on the mere presumption that he was a slave. He was presumed guilty of being a fugitive and had no way to prove himself innocent. I've read the Constitution. Yesterday was Constitution Day. I read it again, and I'm not seeing anywhere where the federal government has delegated a power to do this particular approach to implementing any part of the Constitution for the United States, including the Fugitive Slave Clause. Mike points out that there were also constitutional issues with a provision in the Act that vested commissioners and magistrates with judicial power to issue certificates of removal. It effectively gave them power to judge cases and render verdicts. But, he writes, the Constitution vests judicial authority in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. Now, this is a little bit murkier on the constitutional side. Some people took the position at the time that the Fugitive Slave Act was granting judicial power to court-appointed commissioners, and they really weren't authorized to do that. I don't know for sure whether or not they were correct on that. But on top of all this, these commissioners who were going to hear these cases, hear these trials, whatever you want to call them, they were paid $10 for everyone that they agreed to send back to slavery, and $5 to send someone to freedom, to say, this person claiming you as property is incorrect. I only get half the money. Now, some really good moral people will take the right position one way or the other. But judges are just like judges, magistrates, commissioners are also human beings, and they are motivated sometimes by loot. And I don't think there's any such way of reading due process of law, a fair trial, a fair hearing of any sort, to not only include banning someone from providing testimony in their own defense and then also paying the people responsible for their freedom or slavery double the money to go back to slavery. This is absolutely absurd. I would say just on these things, these are such a severe violation of the compact, the Constitution for these United States on behalf of the federal government, that it was the right and the duty for the states to not only just actively not participate, and to just not just participate, but also to actively thwart and stop the implementation of the federal act and nullify, interpose in a more aggressive way. But that's not the approach that they really took. Northern states, because of the Prigg Act, the Prigg case, they strategically updated or passed new personal liberty laws. Now, they got a little bit more aggressive post-1855, and Ohio had actually got a little bit less aggressive. For example, the Massachusetts Personal Liberty Act of 1855, which I have up here on the screen, it's still archived at the state of Massachusetts. Wild that they have this. But I will link to this in the show notes. I forgot to mention all the stuff that I'm covering here today, all the source documents, the articles, etc. These are going to be included in a blog post over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty. Alan Mosley is organizing the blog post for that, and he usually gets that done within a few hours after the live stream is done. So that'll be up over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty a little bit later today after the live stream is done here this morning. So the Massachusetts Personal Liberty Act, I will include a link to this plus everything else, made it illegal for any state or local government official to aid in the capture of a fugitive slave. This is within the bounds of the anti-commandeering doctrine. You're not going to help. It also denied the use of state jails to be used in the housing of captured runaways. Now, the feds didn't have any fugitive slave runaway, fugitive slave jails. So they had to rely on the states. And when the state said you can't even house them here, it made it much more difficult for them to be able to pull this off. And if you think about it, in modern times, what would the feds do? They're going to rent out a motel room and have it, not just a motel room, an entire floor of a motel and have it guarded 24/7. It's not going to work. When the feds have to rely on the states to do something to implement a federal program, all the founders agreed, including Alexander Hamilton, who was actually complaining about it in the Federalist Papers about that kind of a notion, that all the states would have to do is not to act, as Hamilton put it, or act evasively, and the federal act would be defeated. So the Massachusetts Personal Liberty Act made it illegal for state and local officials to help catch runaways. It also denied the use of state jails, and it granted people the right to habeas corpus as well. Now, get this. Any person, I think this is Section 9 of the Act, any person who shall grant any certificate under or by virtue of the Acts of Congress, that's 1793 and 1850, quote, shall be deemed to have resigned any commission from the Commonwealth which he may possess. His office shall be deemed vacant, and he shall be forever thereafter ineligible to any office of trust, honor, or emolument under the laws of this Commonwealth. So basically, if you are participating in the enforcement of the Federal Fugitive Slave Act of 1793 or 1850, Massachusetts is saying, if you work for the government, you've lost your job, you will never get it back. And that was very effective because a lot of times what they would do is they'd try to find people who had worked as judges or within the government apparatus to be able to hear these act as commissioners, for example. Now, judges of the state of Massachusetts who took a job as a commissioner for the Fugitive Slave Act, they didn't automatically lose their job, but it was officially included in the act that it was considered grounds for impeachment. So a lot of the northern abolitionists were all on board with this. Some of them were great on the Constitution. Some of them were not. For example, John Greenleaf Whittier put it this way. As far as that law is concerned, I am a nullifier. People were asking to run for Congress, and he's saying, oh, man. And if you think about this in response, or just a couple of decades, not even two full decades after the so-called nullification crisis in South Carolina, most of the Northerners weren't on board with the idea of nullification. They thought this was evil. A lot of the Northerners did. But even though they were on board with nullification during 1812 and so, but it flips back and forth. John Greenleaf Whittier saying, I can't run because a lot of my colleagues are going to say, you know, you're a nullifier. But he was proudly saying this. And he said, so far as that law is concerned, I am a nullifier. And William Lloyd Garrison, who was a very aggressive abolitionist, he said, this nullification advocated by Mr. Whittier is loyalty to goodness. Well, we also have Walt Whitman's great poem where he said to the states, resist much, obey little. And I've covered that in other episodes as well. Now, as mentioned, I think I mentioned it before, but basically the point is Massachusetts was far from alone on this. So you have a series of personal liberty laws, 1826 or so, 1820-ish to 1842. Then you have 1842 to 1855, and then a little bit more ramp up from 1855 and beyond. But Massachusetts was far from alone. Basically, all the northern states passed some version of this. Some of them went a little bit more aggressive. Others did not. Massachusetts, for example, Michigan forbade the use of local jails. Massachusetts also included kidnapping provisions. If someone had helped catch a runaway and it was turned out that it was found that they really weren't, they were innocent of being a fugitive, then that person would get a $5,000 fine potentially. So basically all the northern states took action against the Federal Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. I agree with them morally and I agree with them constitutionally. If the feds wanted to implement or enforce the Fugitive Slave Clause, this was not the way to do it. But here's how South Carolina put it. They described it this way in December of 1860 in a document called the Declaration of the Immediate Causes which Induce and Justify the Secession of South Carolina from the Federal Union. The top part of it is a lot of really good stuff that mirrored things in the Declaration of Independence. Hey, this is how, you know, this is how freedom works, or this is how unions work. People can leave. States can leave. But then they get into their complaints. And really, the first thing they're listing is northern nullification of the Federal Fugitive Slave Act. I'll just cite this one small part. They said the states of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Iowa have enacted laws which either nullify the acts of Congress or render useless any attempt to execute them. So in other words, this primarily noncompliance and some more aggressive. Ohio, for example, there is a Oberlin-Wellington rescue. There was a situation where some people tried to arrest some feds and there was a deal made and people got released. There was also a situation in Wisconsin, one in Syracuse, New York. There were some situations where they definitely went beyond that line that the Supreme Court approved for them. But some people will say, you know what? This Federal Fugitive Slave Act was such a severe violation of the Fifth Amendment. This was their duty to do so. So that's I'll leave that one up to you. But here's how Mike Meharry sums it up. It's important strategy for today. Why are we going through all this history? Well, we can learn that when states refuse to participate, just like James Madison told us in Federalist 46, they can create an environment the federal government would be hardly willing to encounter. And here's how Mike put it. Northern nullification of the Fugitive Slave Acts provide us with a blueprint to limit federal power today. We do not have to obediently submit to every act of Congress. And additionally, it also tears to pieces the notion that nullification was just used by racists. I mean, that's absurd in the first place. But here's the actual proof. Now, I know some people disagree and they take the position that the states had no right to do this. That's a different discussion. The fact of the matter is the northern states did this against a federal slavery law. And so therefore, that in and of itself proves that nullification is not inherently a racist institution, which is the general view of most people today. So I think that's an important part of this message. But Mike also points out we do not have to obediently submit to every act of Congress. States can simply refuse to cooperate or provide material support when the federal government overreaches its authority or simply passes bad law. And that's an important point because Madison told us in Federalist 46, again, the states don't have to participate in helping the feds. Now, this does not apply to state courts, but the states, the executive departments, local governments, etc., they do not have to help implement or enforce federal acts or regulatory programs. And Mike says, as Madison insisted and the Northern abolitionists demonstrated, these actions can, quote, and this is from Madison's words, present obstructions which the federal government would hardly be willing to encounter. A lot of information in here today. I hope you found this interesting. I hope it was educational. I love going through this history, and I love sharing it with you. If you want to help us get this kind of information out to more people, absolutely nothing helps us do this work every day more than the financial faith and support of our members. You can join us for as little as $2 a month over at 10thAmendmentCenter.com/members. We also have annual, lifetime, and five-year options over there as well. So if you got a couple of bucks or more of some of that dirty government fiat that they keep devaluing day in and day out, year in and year out, throw it our way again, 10thAmendmentCenter.com/members. Don't forget to smash like buttons, leave reviews on the podcast platforms, Apple Podcasts and elsewhere. All these things will help potentially trigger algorithms of these mainstream platforms and help get the show out to more people. Again, I hope you enjoyed the episode. I hope you had a great weekend. I hope your Monday's off to a good start. And I hope to see you next time here on the Path to Liberty.